Okay, this is the second half of the third week's Evidence for Jesus class. Unfortunately, when I taught the class today, I forgot to hit the forward button on the recorder. So I'm going to have to do a sort of a pretend class. The audience is not going to be there. Kind of a shame because we had a lot of really great questions from the audience. Let me get started. Actually, it started with a question from Chris Jacome, and he was talking a little bit about examples. Where the Bible, the four different gospel accounts don't contradict, but they're different, and it's evidence of having independent witnesses. And the example he used was the two people on the cross, whereas one gospel mentions that obviously both of the thieves were thieves, they were terrible people, but it doesn't mention what is mentioned in another gospel, which is that actually, one of the two thieves repented and Jesus and praised Jesus, and Jesus said, "Today you're going to be with me in paradise." And some people say this is evidence that the story's made up, because how could you not mention that? And again, this is as with these other ones, it's a bad argument, because obviously none of the gospel writers will mention every single thing that happened. And the fact is that one of them chose to mention that detail, the other did not. And if the one gospel writer said that neither of the thieves repented, that would be a contradiction. But he doesn't say that. He simply says there were two thieves, one on his right, one on his left. And he doesn't mention, some of them mention Mary and about John saying to G Mary saying to, sorry, Jesus saying to Mary, "Here's your son," and all that kind of stuff. Others don't. Some mention him being pierced. Others don't. These are evidence that we have separate, independent witnesses. And going back to the courtroom example, if in that courtroom that I mentioned with all those witnesses, if everybody said exactly the same story, if everybody had the same story, that would make each person's testimony of much, much less value, because there'd be evidence that they colluded one another. But if, on the other hand, if you have what we have with the New Testament, which is different testimony, some of which could at first glance appear to be contradictory, but in fact is not. If one person saw one thing, one person saw another, one person interpreted this way at the time, another person interpreted another, this is not evidence that the witnesses are not reliable. In fact, it's evidence of separate, reliable accounts. Three of them being eyewitness accounts: Peter through Mark, John and Matthew, and of course Luke. Luke, who's an incredible historian. In fact, that's what I want to spend the next few minutes talking about. I want to talk about Luke as an historian. And if we could establish that Luke was what I believe he was, which is a historian of the highest order, a very, very highly professional, reliable, accurate, careful, systematic, thoughtful historian, if that is true, then the entire gospel message is true. Because he records where Jesus was born, where he came from, the claim that his mother was a virgin, the many, many details about the miracles and about the resurrection and the crucifixion and the early ministry of Jesus. You have to remember, he wrote Luke and Acts. So I want to talk a little bit about Luke as an historian. Luke records 95 different places, dozens of different rulers. In every case that we can check whether or not his facts agree with what we know from other sources, every single time, he turns out to be very, very reliable. For example, in the Roman times, the array of names that were used for the different political leaders, tetrarch, tribune, legate, and there were literally dozens of different names given to all these different leaders of the cities and the provinces and the governors and all these things. And in fact, to keep track of this was very, very confusing. And yet, of the people that Luke gives a title to, every single one that we have evidence about their name from other sources, Luke is always right. Why would Luke give these kinds of details? Well, in his gospel, he said, "Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught." So the reason Luke gave so many historical details is because he, not because he's trying to cover up for some kind of a lie, but because he wanted to really give people more confidence. Luke included all kinds of historical details. For example, in Luke 2, verse 1 through 3, he's giving historical context to the birth of Jesus and the birth of John the Baptist. He says, in Luke 2, 1 through 3, he says, "In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. This was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria, and everyone went to his own town to register." Now, every single detail in this claim in Luke 2, 1 through 3 has been questioned by the skeptics. And what they're saying is Luke made this up. There was no census. This whole idea about being raised in Nazareth and being born in Bethlehem, that this is just made up to try to cover their tracks, essentially, to kind of patch up the obvious lies. But the fact is, this doesn't work very well. And one thing Luke did was he gave a lot of historical context, and this allows us to check whether he's reliable. For example, what about the census? People said the Romans never did censuses anywhere in their empire. That was a common claim of the skeptics. They said the very idea that they would ask people to travel for as many as hundreds of miles to go to their hometown rather than register for the census where they lived was ridiculous, and there's no evidence for that. And also, they said, Quirinius was not governor of Syria. In fact, Quirinius was governor in Syria in 6 AD, beginning in 6 AD, and he certainly wasn't governor of Syria in roughly 5 BC when Jesus was born. All right, well, what are the facts on that? Well, first of all, we have an inscription. It was discovered fairly recently. They found it in Egypt. And here's the quote. "Because of the approaching census, it is necessary that all those residing for any cause away from their homes should at once prepare to return to their own governments in order that they may complete the family registration of the enrollment and that the tilled lands may retain those belonging to them." So what do we have here? Now, this is from Egypt, not from Palestine, but the claim was that Rome never did a census, number one, and that certainly they never required people to go back to their ancestral homes. Now, by the way, just so you know, this inscription, it regards the second census of Augustus. And notice when Luke says in the first census. This census was 11 years later, actually about the time that Quirinius was a governor in Syria. So what we have here is proof that censuses were called, and proof that at least in the case of Egypt, and seems reasonable to believe as well in the case of Palestine, that people were asked to go back to their ancestral homes, which explains why it is that although Jesus was raised in Nazareth, he actually was born in Bethlehem, as prophesied, of course. Now, about Quirinius being the governor of Syria, it turns out, until fairly recently, all the evidence from the sources had Quirinius being governor of Syria beginning in 6 AD. And the charge then is Luke was kind of just vaguely aware who was governor when, and so he basically made up the story about Quirinius to cover his tracks. In fact, Quirinius had been governor at least 11 years after the birth of Jesus, and proving again that Luke is just making it up. He's mixing up his details. He doesn't, you know, he's kind of patching it together. He's, you know, shooting from the hip, etc. Well, the fact is, in Palestine, an inscription was found that showed it is true that Quirinius, at least put it this way, there's no direct written confirmation that Quirinius was governor of Syria in 5 BC. But here's the deal. Quirinius was consul. And a consul is, by the way, is a much higher level in the Roman system than a governor. He was consul of Galatia and Cilicia with broad powers over that whole region to put down rebellion and to defend against the Parthians. So basically then, he was the governor of the entire area, which included Syria, in 5 BC. Was he actually appointed as governor of Syria at that time? We can't say whether he was or whether he wasn't, but the fact is that Quirinus was governor of Syria, and he was the one governing Syria at the time of Jesus' birth. So I would say, basically, this confirms these details in Luke chapter 2. Anyway, another example of this kind of thing, where Luke is giving us details, which he wouldn't have to do. And remember, when people are lying, they tend to give as few details as possible in the hopes that they can kind of cover their tracks and, you know, they can make things up as they go along. But not Luke. For example, regarding the time of John the Baptist's ministry, here's what he said in Luke chapter 3. In the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, when Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, Herod, tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip, tetrarch of Etruria and Trachonitis, and Lysanias, tetrarch of Abilene, during the high priest of Annas, priesthood of Annas, and Caiaphas, the word of God came to John, son of Zechariah, in the desert. And again, virtually every single thing that's claimed by Luke in this section in Luke chapter 3 has been challenged by the critics, saying clearly Luke didn't know what he's talking about, he's faking it, he's unreliable, probably written in the second century, which actually that nobody believes anymore. Well, it turns out virtually all these claims of Luke have been confirmed. For example, and by the way, to those of you who are listening, I strongly urge you to pull up the PowerPoint from the website so you can kind of follow along with some of the pictures here. For example, if you look at the picture about Luke, it says Luke, an accurate historian, we can see what's known as the Pilate stone from Caesarea. And it's in Latin, obviously. And it says Tiberius Pilatus Procuratus. What it confirms then is that Pilate was indeed the procurator. And by the way, some people had said that he got it wrong. He should have said governor. But in fact, he was procurator, exactly like Luke had said. And it confirms not only that he was procurator of Judea, but he was procurator of Judea during the time of Tiberius. So this detail of what Luke said about John the Baptist is in fact true. Also, Herod, tetrarch of Galilee. I don't have the inscription, but it turns out there is an inscription found that confirms that not only that Herod was tetrarch, that he was the ruler of Galilee, but specifically that he was tetrarch. In fact, his father, Herod the Great, was known as King Herod. But this Herod, who's the son of King Herod, Herod was indeed called tetrarch, agreeing with Luke's title in Luke chapter 3. Also, it says, during the high priest of Annas and Caiaphas, it turns out that this detail, which is basically that Annas was the high priest and Caiaphas was the acting high priest, that has been confirmed by outside sources. In fact, if you look at the slide here, I have to go down about four slides here, to the Caiaphas ossuary. In fact, this is the actual ossuary of the high priest, known as Caiaphas, who was the high priest during the ministry of John the Baptist, as reported by Luke. And the reason we know this is, I don't know if you look closely, but there's an inscription on the side of the Caiaphas ossuary that gives the details about who he's the son of and all that kind of stuff, and it confirms that this is the actual ossuary, the bone box, of the Caiaphas, who was the high priest at the time Luke says that he was indeed the high priest. And then there's Lysanias. Again, people said, who's this Lysanias? We have no record of this guy Lysanias being a tetrarch in Abilene. And by the way, we're not talking about Abilene, Texas, or Abilene, Kansas. We're talking about the original Abilene, which is in the area north, in the northeast area of Palestine, kind of towards Syria. But here we go. I'm going to show you. Look at this one here. It's the Lysanias inscription, and it's in Greek. In fact, the interpretation to the right on the slide is also in Greek. But if you can see where I'm pointing right now, It says Lysanias Tetrarchus. All right, so what we, and by the way, this was found, guess where? In Abilene. So it confirms not only that Lysanias was the ruler of Abilene, but that he was called the Tetrarch. So Lysanias, Tetrarch of Abilene, as claimed by Luke, is true. And of course, Luke is writing his letter about 30, 35 years after this, and it confirms that he was a very, very careful researcher. He got the details correct. So if you go back to the passage we read in Luke 3, we've confirmed that it was indeed during the reign of Tiberius Caesar, that indeed Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, actually a procurator, as Luke said, that Herod was tetrarch, and I don't know if we have confirmation of Philip being tetrarch in Etruria, and Trachonitis, but that Lysanias was tetrarch in Abilene. So I'd say the evidence is that Luke was a very careful historian. Another fun example is Luke names 32 countries and 54 cities and 9 islands without a single error. He specifically said, and forgive me for this rather small detail, it's in the notes, that Lystra and Derbe, which were part of Paul's first missionary trip, were in the province of Lycaonia, but Iconium was not in the province of Lycaonia, that it was actually in the province of Phrygia. Now, that's in Acts 14:6. Interestingly, the great orator Cicero, who you would think would be a very careful person, a very, very famous scholar and writer and all that, Cicero, in his writings, said that Iconium was part of Lycaonia. Well, it turns out that Luke is right and Cicero was wrong. In fact, in 1910, Sir William Ramsay found an inscription in Iconium that confirmed that Iconium at this time was considered part of the province of Phrygia. Again, do you really care about this? I don't, because we don't know about this. But during the time that Luke wrote, these places, Iconium, Derbe, Lystra, were all well known. And Luke is giving all kinds of context, confirming for anybody who's willing to check it out that indeed what he said happened is in fact what happened. Here's another interesting one. Now, this actually doesn't come from Luke. It comes from Romans 16:23. Here, Paul in his letter wrote, Erastus, the city treasurer, greets you. And so, according to Paul, Erastus was the city treasurer of Corinth, and he was a Christian, and he was greeting the church. And if you look at the slide, it's called the Erastus inscription in the PowerPoint, and you can see Erastus, whatever his title was. The bottom line is, this was in a road, so it was actually an inscription on a road right there in Corinth, confirming that, yes, indeed, Erastus was a high city official in Corinth at the time that Paul said he was. All right, so there's many more details we can use, but the bottom line is Luke is not only reliable, he is an excellent historian. Let me conclude this section by reading some quotes from Sir William Ramsay, who was an important scholar, archaeologist, scholar, and historian. He began as quite a skeptic of biblical reliability, but when he did his research on Paul, it changed his mind. I'm going to read it. This is actually a slide if you want to look in the PowerPoint. I found myself brought into contact with the book of Acts as an authority for the topography, antiquities, and society of Asia Minor. It was gradually borne upon me that in various details the narrative showed marvelous truth. In fact, beginning with a fixed idea that the work was essentially a secondary composition. By the way, let me stop right there. This is in the early 1900s when the critics of Christianity were claiming that the Gospels were written in the 2nd century and that Luke was written in the 2nd century, and they're completely unreliable. Nobody today would have the nerve to say that any of the Gospels, other than perhaps John, were written in the 2nd century. And nobody would claim anymore today that Luke was written in the 2nd century. But it's interesting, Sir William Ramsay believed that. The reason no, even the skeptics don't claim that is, the bottom line is, no skeptic, unless they're willing to look foolish, is willing to make these claims, because they'll be immediately shouted down by their skeptical, unbelieving friends. Anyway, so back to this. I began with the fixed idea that the work was essentially a second century composition and never relying on its evidence as trustworthy for first century conditions. I gradually came to find it a useful ally in some obscure and difficult investigations. Luke, this is his conclusion. He goes on and gives many examples in the original work. And then this is a conclusion about Luke. Luke is a historian of the first rank. Not merely are his statements of fact trustworthy, he's possessed of the true historic sense. He fixes his mind on the idea and plan that rules in the evolution of history. He proportions the scale of his treatments to the importance of each incident. He seizes the important and critical events, shows their true nature at greater length, while he touches lightly or omits entirely much that was valueless for his purpose. In short, this author should be placed along with the very greatest of historians. So much for the claim that the New Testament documents are not reliable. In fact, they are extremely reliable. In fact, I would say reliable to an absolutely remarkable degree. All right. Now, I'm going to go on here. I'm going to go into our next section, which is on archaeology and Jesus. Now, to be honest with you, we don't have a whole lot of new stuff here to look at, but I want to mention a few. First of all, if you're looking at the PowerPoint, here's the Pool of Siloam. And again, well into the 20th century, those who were trying to claim that, you know, that the Gospels are just myths and made-up stories and, you know, a few things maybe happen, but basically it's just somebody making stuff up. They claimed that there was no Pool of Siloam. Well, if you're looking at the PowerPoint, you're now seeing the Pool of Siloam. All right, and in fact, as is described in the Gospels, there were five series of colonnades. You're actually seeing some of the rocks in the inscription that were from those colonnades. And there was an upper pool and a lower pool. You're looking at the lower pool here. And what's interesting, if you read the Gospel accounts, as, for example, in John, it reports the idea that the water would be stirred, and there was this myth about it being an angel stirring the water. Anyway, it turns out that the facts are that there was an upper pool, and the water would be released from the upper pool so that the water in the lower pool would be running, because for the Jews, they wanted to do their baptisms and their washings in living water rather than still water. And to them, running water was living water, and living water was better than running water. So for those of you who are baptized in a pool or something like that, to the Jews in the first century, they would have said, that's not so great. But anyway, so you can see the Pool of Siloam. Yes, it's a real place. It did have water running through it, and it agrees with the New Testament description. Of course, another important New Testament archaeological finding is the Pilate inscription. We already talked about that one, the Caiaphas ossuary. Okay, here's one more. It's a heel bone of a crucified man. This was discovered fairly recently. And what it is a, as you can see, it's a huge steel spike that was driven through the ankles of a man. This was found in an ossuary. And apparently this person, even though he's crucified, was given a fairly dignified burial. And the claim, of course, of the critics is there's no way they would have buried a criminal, a crucified criminal, in a nice grave like the Bible claims with Nicodemus. Actually, not Nicodemus, his friend's grave. But anyway, so here you can see, first of all, confirming that indeed crucifixion was piercing of the ankle, as is described in the Gospels. In fact, it was sent through the leg in a way so that it wouldn't break any of the major bones. Again, consistent with the Gospel description. So, like I said, there's not a huge amount of new archaeological information that confirms the Gospels, but there's plenty of that. Most of our confirmation comes from history rather than archaeology. But we do have the Lysanias inscription, the Caiaphas ossuary, the Pool of Siloam, the Lysanias inscription, the Erastus inscription. There's plenty of physical evidence confirming the general idea of the historical liability of the New Testament. Okay, now I'm going to start, and we're not going to finish it today. I'm just going to get started. I'm going to start what is probably my favorite section, is that on messianic prophecies. Let's go to Luke 24, verse 44. I'm going to read that. We're going to be reading a bunch of prophecies about the Messiah. And if these prophecies were indeed prophecies written 100 years before, and if Jesus indeed did these things, I would say it gives virtually irrefutable evidence that Jesus is who he says he is, and that the Bible is inspired by God. I find it hard to really have any other reasonable conclusion. Anyway, let's read Luke 24:44. Then he told them, "These are my words that I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms must be fulfilled." By the way, just so you know, the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms are the three divisions of the Hebrew Bible. So basically what he's saying, everything about the written about the Messiah in the Jewish Bible was written about me, and I need to make sure I fulfill all those prophecies. And he's claiming that he did. All right, that is quite an amazing claim. And by the way, just so you know, there were a number of questions at this point. How do the Jews feel about these messianic prophecies? How do they feel about the Messiah today? How do they deal with questions about what the Messiah should be like and messianic prophecy? That's a really good question. And one of the facts that I mentioned at the time is that the Jews definitely had an idea in the time of Jesus, clearly, that a Messiah was going to come. They were aware of many passages in their scriptures that foretold about the Messiah. And at the time, there were a number of readings from what we call the Old Testament. They would call it the Bible. There were a bunch of readings that were in their weekly services in the synagogues from these messianic prophecies. And here's an interesting fact. We know from records that sometime during the first couple few centuries, almost all the messianic prophecies that were regularly read in the synagogue were literally removed from the regular readings. Why do you think that is? Well, the fact is that the Jews were very well aware, number one, that these were messianic prophecies, and that their fellow Jews considered them messianic prophecies, and number two, that Jesus had in fact fulfilled these, and number three, that that those who were coming to the synagogue were aware of this. And clearly, their choice was to, what I would say, rather cynically remove these prophecies from the regular readings because it was causing people to convert to Christianity. Now, you would think that if you had evidence that said that these things are true, that rather than excise the evidence to kind of essentially do a cover-up, you might want to consider possibly becoming a Christian. All right, now what we're going to do is, I mentioned a few other things. For example, that today, yes, many Jews do expect a Messiah to come, but there are many Jews who don't even believe in God. I mean, they're cultural Jews, there are conservative Jews, there are Orthodox Jews, there are liberal Jews. Some take the Messianic prophecies more specifically, reliably than others. Some of the messianic prophecies, they tend to downplay simply because clearly, it doesn't make sense that they be fulfilled. For example, in Daniel 9, as we'll see, when it says that the Messiah will come to Jerusalem somewhere around 30 AD, they're not going to really talk about that so much. And when he'd be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver, we don't even use silver anymore. So there's some prophecies of the Messiah that the Jews tend to downplay, and there are others that they play up a bit more. Also, even today, I believe it to be fair to say that most of the Jews who expect a Messiah have a vision of the Messiah a little bit different than we do as Christians. They have a Messiah coming to kind of ride into town and save the Jews and be a political leader, perhaps even a military leader, a powerful man of the world who takes control. All right, and those prophecies that picture the Messiah that way, they're going to talk about. Those that don't, they're probably not going to really use so much. Isaiah 53, for example. Anyway, so here's the approach we're going to take. We're going to kind of pretend, if you will, that we're cynics, or not cynics, we're critics. We're people who are very, very difficult to convince. So what we're going to do is we're going to propose four reasonable questions that a person who is, you know, really looking for some evidence, a person, maybe not a cynic, that's a bit too strong, a person who is rather skeptical of Christianity. So the four questions we're going to consider here are, number one, how do I know that these prophecies were in fact written hundreds of years before the events? Number two, how do I know these things really happened? Number three, are these in fact prophecies of Messiah rather than something that Jesus and Christians just kind of take out of context, kind of scan the Bible, try to look for things about Jesus that kind of sort of similar to the Old Testament? And question number four, could Jesus have kind of faked the whole thing? Read the Jewish Bible, seen Messiah supposed to do this, that, and the other thing, and saying, all right, great, I'm just going to make sure I do that, and then I could kind of back up my claim to be the Messiah. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk, as we go through these messianic prophecies, we're going to come back to these four questions and deal with them. And you have to admit they're reasonable questions. I mean, a reasonable person should not simply accept that Jesus is who the Bible says he is just because Christians say so. And so, and you know, obviously it's reasonable to ask, maybe, maybe the Christians inserted these things into the Bible to make it look like Jesus fulfilled them. All right, so let's talk about question number one. How do I know that these prophecies were indeed written hundreds of years before the events? Now, my first point is this. First of all, these are part of the Jewish Bible. Every single scripture we're going to be reading in this section, and there's quite a few, are still today part of the Hebrew Bible. And if you read a Jewish translation of Psalms 22, of Isaiah 53, of Zechariah 11, of Micah 5, of Isaiah 9, of Isaiah 7, you're going to find out that the Jewish translations, the Jewish Bibles, say virtually the same thing if they're a good translation. So this proves that the Christians did not somehow change the Bible, the Old Testament, later on in order to kind of create this false idea that Jesus was the Messiah. First of all, why in the world would they do that? Obviously, they believed that he was the Messiah. Anybody who's cynical enough to change the Bible to create this false impression that Jesus was the Messiah, then obviously wouldn't believe that Jesus was the Messiah. And why would they risk their life, to create this false Bible? Because you have to understand, we have complete manuscripts of the Old Testament from before this. So this is really quite ludicrous that somehow the Jews would have been convinced to use a Bible that was changed by Christians in order to make it more believable that Jesus was the Messiah. Second of all, we have the Septuagint translation. Now, the Septuagint translation is a Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. It was made starting somewhere around 240 BC. It's on the slides here, it says 250 to 150. What I'm doing here is I'm being very, very conservative. Probably the entire Septuagint was complete by 200 BC. The Talmud records how there were 70 men and they went into 70 different rooms and they all came out with 70 translations exactly the same. I don't think we need to take that seriously. But here's the bottom line. All these prophecies, Isaiah, Psalms, we're going to quote from Genesis, all these prophecies were part of the Jewish Bible and were translated into the Septuagint, the Greek Bible, at least 200 years before Jesus was even born. So that proves beyond a reasonable doubt that these are documents that are hundreds of years before Jesus lived. Also, there are the Dead Sea Scrolls. If you look on the screen here, We have Qumran cave number four. That's the cave that the most scrolls were found. Now, these were discovered in the 1940s. Beginning in 46, there was a shepherd boy who went into this cave and found these clay jars with very ancient texts. Anyway, there are hundreds and hundreds of manuscripts. Many of them are from 1st and 2nd century BC documents of these people called the Essenes. But many, a majority of them, are actually biblical manuscripts. And the evidence is when the Jewish rebellion happened in the 60s AD, they took all their scrolls and hid them in these caves for safekeeping. Anyway, if you go to the next slide, we can see the Isaiah scroll. There are actually three important Isaiah scrolls found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. One of them, the great Qumran Isaiah scroll, is an entire book of Isaiah, and it's from 150 BC. Some of the Dead Sea Scrolls are from as early as 250 BC. So what we have here is absolute ironclad proof that these books existed hundreds of years before Jesus was born. In fact, since they are part of the Jewish scriptures as early as 250 BC, beyond any reasonable doubt, I think we can reasonably say, even if we're being very conservative, that every single one of these prophecies that we're quoting from have been around at least since 300 BC. So that means well over 300 years before the events. And that's a long time. 300 years ago. All right, just for example, 1615. Plymouth Rock. Jamestown had been settled, but Plymouth Rock, the pilgrims hadn't come there yet. That's how long we're talking about. So indeed, question number one, I think, is pretty well settled. Question number two, how do I know these things really happen? Now, what I've done is I'm going to choose a group of about eight prophecies in the beginning of the story. And most of the things in these prophecies are matters of historical record by pagan or Jewish writers. Not all of them, but a little bit over half of them are. We've already seen earlier in the class Josephus, who mentions Pontius Pilate and the Christians and about Jesus, and Cornelius Tacitus, who mentions his crucifixion under Pontius Pilate, and the Jewish Talmud, the fact that he was from Nazareth and he was born in Bethlehem, all these things. So the fact is that we do not simply have New Testament writers as evidence these things happen. And besides, we've just finished discussing how most of these people, many of them who wrote these things, were martyrs. They spent their life under immediate threat of death at any time. And the idea that they would write stuff that's a total lie to support a religion that they didn't really believe in, so that they could be persecuted and hounded for the rest of their life, this really makes no sense. But nevertheless, question number two, how do we know these things really happened? Well, we have archaeological evidence, we have the obvious evidence of the reliability of the actual writers, and then many of these messianic prophecies, their fulfillment are a matter of historical record outside the Bible. All right, the third question is, how do we know these, in fact, are prophecies of the Messiah? Now, here's the standard I'm going to use. The standard I'm going to use is, if we know that the Jews in the time of Jesus considered these actually to be prophecies of the Messiah, then they are, in fact, prophecies of the Messiah. Every single one of this list of about eight or nine that I'm going to use in the initial part of this lecture are prophecies that were considered messianic by the Jews in the first century. The only exception will be Psalms 22. I am going to be using Psalms 22, which, to be honest with you, as far as I know, was not listed or thought of as a messianic prophecy by the Jews at the time, and you'll see why. So the bottom line is, these are not being taken out of context, not at all. Now, I'm going to be honest with you, there are some prophecies that I believe are messianic that the Jews didn't see necessarily as messianic. Hosea 11:1, out of Egypt I called my son. So there are messianic prophecies that the New Testament writers quote as prophecies of the Messiah. I'm not using those, but there are some. So, you know, there are some prophecies that we Christians believe are messianic, which I think you could probably argue that perhaps, maybe, we could at least, you could argue that we're taking them out of context and et cetera. But the ones I'm using in this outline simply are not that. Okay, question number four. Could Jesus, planning on deceiving the people into believing he was the Messiah, have read the Old Testament and tried to fulfill all these prophecies in order to have this mass conspiracy to have thousands and thousands of followers, so he could have this awesome, great religion, so everybody would be falling at his feet, throwing money at him, he'd get lots of beautiful women, and have this great religion, and have a wonderful life where everybody thinks he's great? Okay, now, first of all, that's not exactly how it turned out. In fact, the prophecies that Jesus was reading involved him being, as you can see in the slideshow, having him being beaten, having him being crucified and pierced and rejected and despised. All right, those are the things that he would have to go out of his way to make sure that he did so he could be the Messiah. And that seems to kind of defeat the whole idea of being this awesome, amazing Messiah where you're having lots of great people saying how great you are and how you have this nice country home and et cetera. And in fact, but here's the fact. What we're going to do is we're going to go through several of these messianic prophecies, and we're going to find out, in fact, many of these things he absolutely could not have arranged to have happened because it has to do with stuff that he had absolutely no control over whatsoever. So the answer to this fourth question is either he had no control over it, or yes, I suppose maybe he did, but the fact is that in fulfilling these things, it meant he was going to get tortured and killed. So I would say this skeptic's question number four is pretty easily answered. Okay, now, just so you know, if you're listening, I'm going to finish in about 10 or 15 minutes, and we're not going to get through the entire outline. We're going to do the first four of about eight messianic prophecies. So let's go to Isaiah 53, 1 through 13. Now, I'm not going to read the entire scripture because I assume that most people listening to this class are pretty familiar with the general idea that Isaiah 53 is, in fact, a messianic prophecy. And by the way, just so you know, we know from the first century writings of early Christians that, in fact, some but not all Jews considered Isaiah 53 to be a messianic prophecy. It was actually mentioned by the Essenes as a messianic prophecy. So that settles that question. Now, in verse 3 of Isaiah 53, it says that he was despised and rejected by men, a man of suffering who knew what sickness was all about. He was one from whom men turned away. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. Now, is it a historical fact from data we have outside of the Bible that Jesus was, in fact, despised and rejected of men, and a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering? And at this point, everybody in the class goes, well, yeah, obviously. So we don't have to rely simply on the Bible for that. Number two, was this a messianic prophecy? Absolutely. Number three, was this written well before? Yes. Now, I can prove it was written before 300 BC, but the fact is that Isaiah wrote around 720, 730, 710 BC. And even the critics of biblical reliability believe that at least part of Isaiah was probably, in fact, written by an actual person named Isaiah. All right, and number four, could Jesus, wanting to claim to be the Messiah, have said, all right, great, I got to get despised and rejected. Awesome. I'm going to go ahead and get despised and rejected. And the audience agrees, well, yeah, I guess so. I mean, if you want to get despised and rejected, what you could do is go into Jerusalem and tell the Pharisees that they're whitewashed tombs, they're brood of vipers, and hypocrites. So yeah, okay, it's true. Jesus lived a life that clearly was going to get him despised and rejected, and he'd probably have a little bit of suffering. All right, I'll concede that to the skeptic. But how about getting pierced? It says in verse 5, as John mentions in John 19, 31 through 37, that the Messiah would be pierced. Now, wait a minute. I thought he was crucified. Yes, he was crucified, but as John reports, and he's a very reliable witness, and he says, I testify to it. I was there. I'm telling you what I saw, as did many of the Roman soldiers and many who hated Jesus saw, that Jesus was, in fact, pierced. And the reason he was pierced is when they came to break the legs of the two thieves in order to end the execution before the sundown on the day of the Passover there, they came and they broke the legs of the other men. But because Jesus had already been dead, rather than break his legs, they simply stabbed him up into his abdomen with a spear. All right, now, could Jesus have arranged to get pierced? Seems like a good question. Well, I suppose so. Can you imagine him while he's on the cross saying to the soldiers, "Hey, guys, look, do me a favor. In fact, you know, my disciples, they'll pay you. They'll pay you 50 drachma. Here's what I want you to do. When I die, I want you to pierce me with a spear in the side. Trust me, my friends will pay you some bucks to get so that you know, you'll be well paid for this." All right? I suppose. You know what? I don't really think that makes sense. Could Jesus have seen to this happening? Well, yeah, if he's the Son of God. And then in verse 7, he was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. Verse 7. All right, now do we know for a fact that Jesus did not defend himself during the trial outside of the Bible? Well, I guess that's debatable. We do know that he had a trial before Pontius Pilate. We do know that he was convicted and executed. We also know that he didn't do anything that warranted that execution according to Roman ideas. And so, in fact, that it was trumped up charges. So, yeah, I think it's pretty reasonable to assume that it is, in fact, true that the reason he got convicted is because he refused to defend himself. All right? So, yes. Now, could Jesus have done this in order to sort of manipulatively kind of shape history so he could fulfill everything in Isaiah chapter 53? I suppose so. The problem is this was kind of a bad personal plan for his great, awesome life, considering that the result of his refusing to defend himself was a horrible death by torture within just a few hours of when he refused to defend himself. All right, now let's go to our next prophecy, which is Micah chapter 5, verse 2. It says here, "But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you're small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler of Israel, whose origins are from old, from ancient times." Now, this definitely was considered a messianic prophecy by the Jews in the time of Jesus. In fact, this is one of the ones that was quoted in the Jewish services in the synagogue at the time. All right, now, first of all, it's worth noting there are actually two Bethlehems. One of them is larger. Bethlehem Ephrathah is the smaller of the two Bethlehems, and that's the one Jesus was born in. How do we know that? Because of the census. How do you know there was a census? Because we have record of Augustus doing censuses, which required people to go to their hometown, and we know that Jesus was descended from Mary, who was directly descended from David. All right, and so yes, Jesus was in fact born in the same city. So yes, this is written 700 years before. Yes, it's a historical fact that Jesus fulfilled this. Yes, Jesus did it, in fact. And it is a messianic prophecy. Now, could Jesus have arranged to be born in Bethlehem? At this point, of course, the whole class starts laughing a little bit. Ha, 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 ha. And then somebody pointed out, well, yeah, I guess so. He's the Son of God. But that's the whole point. Not only did Jesus fulfill this, and not only could he have not arranged to it, it's clear evidence, I think, a virtually unassailable evidence that Jesus, in fact, is the Messiah, that he is, in fact, the Son of God, and that he is, in fact, who he claimed to be, which is the Son of God, God in the flesh, the Savior of mankind. Now, next is Isaiah 9, verse 1. Let's go there. It's an interesting passage. Isaiah 9. Now, in order to claim to be the Messiah, you have to get born in Bethlehem. All right, and that's one of the reasons when people claim to be the Messiah today, and yes, there's this guy, Rabbi Schneeson, I think his name is, who died about, I think about 15 years ago. He was quite old, I believe in his 90s, something like that. And he was the number of conservative, Orthodox rather, Jews who claimed he was the Messiah. All right, well, I don't think Rabbi Schneeson was born in Bethlehem. All right, but anyway, Isaiah chapter 9, verse 1, it says, "Nevertheless, the gloom of the distressed land will not be like that in the former times. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, but in the future, he'll bring honor by the way of the sea to the land west of the Jordan in the Galilee of the Jews." Sorry for that. Not very good quote there. Anyway, and then in order to confirm this is in fact a messianic prophecy, I'll go down to Isaiah 9, verse 6. For unto us a child is born. He will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Now, if there ever was a messianic prophecy, it's Isaiah chapter 9, verse 1 through 6. And what's it say? What's it saying is the Messiah will bring honor and praise to the land of Zebulun and to the land of Naphtali. Now, if you look at the next slide here, this is a map showing the 12 tribes in their territory. If you notice in brown, you have Naphtali, and in blue, you have Zebulun. And you can see where the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali are. They both lie directly to the west, kind of southwest, but west of the Sea of Galilee. All right, good. Now let's look at the next slide. This is a map of Palestine during the time of Jesus. And look where Nazareth was. Nazareth is mainly to the west, slightly to the south of the Sea of Galilee. In fact, it is smack dab on the border between the territory of what was Zebulun and what was Naphtali. So in order to be the Messiah, you have to come from the region of Zebulun and Naphtali, somewhere close by Nazareth, but you have to be born in Bethlehem. How many people living during the time of Jesus could claim that pedigree? I would say very, very few. Perhaps not a single one. Perhaps Jesus was the only one alive at that time who could, and I would say there's arguably nobody alive today, because it just so happens that Bethlehem is in the West Bank in Arab territory, and Nazareth is in Jewish Israeli territory. All right, good. Our next one comes from Psalm 22. This is the last one we're going to do today. Now, I did say ahead of time that of all the passages we're going to look at, this is the only one that I cannot claim legitimately that the Jews themselves considered to be messianic. But let's read this passage. It says here, "Dogs have surrounded me. A band of evil men have encircled me. They have pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing." All right, is this a messianic prophecy? Well, I think so. Did David have his hands and feet pierced? I like to imagine David, after writing down this interesting psalm, kind of saying to himself, "Gee, that's strange what I wrote. Why did I write that? I can count on my bones. What am I talking about here? They cast lots for my clothing. Is that something that ever happened to David? Was I pierced? What did I just write down?" By the way, there's an interesting side note here. Those who don't believe in Jesus but want to discount the messianic prophecies, here's their approach. You'll never ever get them to talk about all of them in their kind of broad context, because clearly these messianic prophecies are an absolutely compelling story. Here's what they're going to do. They're going to want you to talk about them one at a time, and they're going to try to refute them one at a time. And here's how they deal. This sounds laughable, but here's how they deal with Psalms 22. This is how Muslims deal with Psalms 22. And I know from people trying to debate me at my website, this is how people who are trying to refute messianic prophecies deal with it. It turns out the word pierced here in Hebrew can also mean camel. So they're saying, he's not saying that they pierced my hands and my feet. He's saying that they've cameled my hands and my feet, okay? All right, so now here's a question from the context. Which is a more reliable meaning of this Hebrew word, pierced or camel? And again, at this point, the audience is laughing a little bit. And really, this criticism of Psalms 22 as a messianic prophecy, in my opinion, is actually a borderline laughable. Now what it's saying here is the Messiah will be crucified. When David lived, and when he wrote this psalm, roughly, say, 130 B.C., 1030 B.C., rather, crucifixion didn't even exist. It wasn't even invented until the 4th century B.C. by the Persians. And the Persians did not use piercing of hand and feet. What they did was they tied people by hand and foot to a pole and killed them that way. It was the Romans who invented this horrible torture of nailing hands and feet to a pole and later on with a crossbeam in order to torture them to death by the most horrendous possible execution. In other words, crucifixion was invented 900 years after David wrote this psalm, and well after we know for a fact that the Psalms were translated into Greek from Hebrew, and there's a large number of the Psalms that are found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. All right, so that's that. It is messianic. We know from historical sources that it actually happened. Could Jesus have arranged to get crucified? Well, you know, maybe. But the fact is, it was actually pretty difficult to get crucified, because only the Romans could crucify. And why would the Romans want to kill Jesus? When the Jews did execution, they were only allowed to use stoning. They couldn't have stoned Jesus to death. So the only way to get Jesus crucified was to sort of manipulate the situation. So rather than have the Jews who hated Jesus kill him, he had to get the Romans who had no particular reason to have anything against Jesus to kill him. All right, I suppose you could argue that Jesus set up the situation so he could be crucified, but seriously. Now, what about I can count all my bones? Again, what was David thinking when he wrote that? But here's what I think it's about. In John 19 and in the other Gospels, at least one other Gospel, it records that what happened is, because it was already the sixth hour, Jesus had been dead for a while already, and it was getting near sunset. In order to not have this this execution going on during Passover, they broke the legs of the other two that were crucified with Jesus. But because Jesus was already dead, they didn't break his legs. In fact, they pierced his side. And by the way, when we talk about the Passover, we're going to see there's another prophecy of the Messiah when he's killed not having his bones broken. And then there's dividing garments and casting lots. Now, this brings up a good question. Did they divide his garments, one for you, one for you, one for me? Or did they gamble? Well, according to John 19, they did both. What they did was one for you, one for you, one for me. But when they got to the inner cloth, which was much more valuable than all the other cloths behind, rather than rip it up, they decided to cast lots. Now, could Jesus have arranged that? Can you imagine him, again, up on the cross saying, "Hey, guys, I don't want to say anything here, but don't you think it would be a smart idea to gamble? Gamble? Wouldn't that be better than ripping that thing up? Wouldn't that increase its value?" Again, this is ludicrous. All right, so we're going to continue. I'm about halfway through discussion of Messianic prophecies. We'll continue next week. Anyway, hopefully you enjoyed the class. And again, sorry that I forgot to hit the button. And sorry that some of the really awesome questions that came up during class aren't included in this recording. But thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.